You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. It's bipartisan and icky, and it's always happening in Washington. People who claim access to the president or halls of power, who take millions of dollars to shill for dictators, enemies of democracy, and worse. If you're a Republican, you think Democrats own this appalling behavior. If you're a Democrat, you think the problem is exclusively in the Republican camp. Now, in Kenneth P. Vogel's new book, Devil's Advocate, The Hidden Story of Rudy Giuliani, Hunter Biden, and the Washington Insiders on the Payroll of Corrupt Foreign Interests, you get a sense of how extensive this toxin is, how much it's metastasized into the government. And frankly, this book calls for a cleansing, maybe not a populist cleansing, but something thoughtfully envisioned. Anyway, Ken, thank you very much for coming in. I'm really glad you wrote this book. Glad you're working for the Fourth Estate and for the Times. Can we start with Giuliani? I mean, he was the hero. He was a tough U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. He went after La Cosa Nostra. He was like the LCN slam guy. How did his fate shift to bring him in the world of advocating for these particularly unsavory foreign leaders?
Well, in a word, money. He left the mayoralty, as you alluded to, riding high. He was America's mayor. And that brought with it a certain amount of earning power and a certain amount of cachet, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And he quickly found something that's axiomatic that a lot of these characters in my book realizes, that there was more money to be made overseas and even more money to be made overseas working for less than savory interests. He sort of started out rather quickly after he left Gracie Mansion. He was in Ukraine. He was working for or with Vladimir Klitschko, whichever one of the Klitschko brothers became the mayor of Kyiv. But then he was introduced to less savory characters and folks who had more ties to Moscow and to the Kremlin by one of these sort of matchmaking services for well-connected Americans who are essentially for hire by these foreign interests, a group called Tri-Global Strategies. He did quite well for himself, but he really craved the spotlight, like the domestic U.S. spotlight. And first it led him to run for president in a spectacularly unsuccessful fashion in 2008. But then as his profile faded, so too did his earning power to some extent. And when Donald Trump burst onto the scene and declared his presidential campaign in 2015, Rudy Giuliani was one of the first, really one of the only at the time, high-profile establishment Republicans to sign on and support the campaign. And, you know, maybe some of that was because of his loyalty to and shared experience with Donald Trump, but certainly talking to people around him, some of that was a craving for the spotlight, and in concert with that, a desire to boost his political relevance, which would boost his earning power and allow him to resume those big paydays on the foreign buck-raking circuit. And he did that, but he also wanted to become Secretary of State. And he wanted to become Secretary of State under Donald Trump. And he believed that his experience on the sort of foreign influence circuit would actually be a selling point for an incoming Trump administration. And at the time, in late 2016, early 2017, Trump had some folks around him who were sort of took a more traditional view of Senate confirmation processes and what was acceptable and unacceptable among nominees for high profile positions, including Chris Christie. And Chris Christie famously flagged Rudy Giuliani's foreign work and said, this is not going to pass muster in the Senate. And so he didn't get anything. It was a great disappointment to him. And he instead sort of created this own role as almost like a shadow Secretary of State, where he resumed his foreign work, going, you know, around the world and sort of shaking the money tree. And he had this heightened relevance again. He was one of the few people who had the ear of this outsider disruptive president in early 2017, who didn't really trust a lot of people in the traditional foreign policy establishment or really in Washington writ large. And so suddenly Rudy Giuliani was marketable again, and he really blurred the line. He embraced this sort of role where he was President Trump's private attorney, but was sort of going around the world and meeting with foreign leaders and foreign businesses and sort of casting him, or at least not dissuading them from believing that he was the guy you hired to get to Trump. And he was whispering in Trump's ear about these foreign clients that he had and suggesting changes to U.S. foreign policy or sometimes U.S. law enforcement policy that would have favored these people. And this most famously blew up, backfired in a spectacular way for both him and Trump. With the first impeachment, like that was all Rudy whispering in Trump's ear about what to do in Ukraine in a way that maybe there was a way that this could have been a political benefit for Trump and not backfire. But it was definitely in the interest of some of the foreign interests with whom he was working at the time.
One of the things that jumped out from your book was a desire to either reestablish relevance or attain relevance in Washington. I would also point out separately, this whole thing with Giuliani, you make a good point. And I think you were very fair to the people that you wrote about. I mean, these guys were pals, right? They rode high in New York back in the day. Donald Trump had cameos in movies as sort of the nice guy, right? You know, he would talk to Macaulay Culkin or whatever in Home Alone. But they knew each other for a long time. And I think it is just patently hard to just turn around and say, you know, my friend's leading me down this terribly awful path, or I shouldn't listen to them when they've ridden so high and they've been so important. I think you were, frankly, very fair to the people that you wrote about. But let's talk about a couple of the other people that Giuliani was representing. I don't get a sense when I see him in this interview that he understands where he's fallen to. Like, I think he seems confused about that.
There's a few things going on. He clearly had a huge ego, and so it was hard for him to not be in center stage. And he adjusted, in the case of Trump, by being sort of at the foot of or in the ear of the person who was at center stage. But, you know, it was also tied to his like feelings of self-worth and his personal relationships that all sort of were collapsing around the time, you know, that were strained, including his marriage, I should say, at the time that he lost this presidential campaign. And it was becoming clear, whether it was clear to him, it was certainly clear to the people around him, that his days as like a principal in politics were numbered. And if he was going to hang around in politics and on the lucrative side of politics and sort of the professional consulting or influence sphere, it was going to be as like a secondary figure. To the extent that he accepted that, he still behaved in certain ways as if he was the one who was like cutting the deal. So like, I give like an example where he was representing this Turkish gold trader who was on trial and was a favorite of Erdogan. You know, he goes into the Oval Office and like tells Trump that he should drop the case against this guy because it would be a great favor for Erdogan. And Rex Tillerson is there at the time, and they, the first Secretary of State for Trump, and they have this huge throwdown. And Rudy is like behaving as if like, no, he is preeminent in this situation because he's friends with Trump, and he still sort of, again, sees himself as like a principal who's kind of setting, I mean, in that case, it would be foreign policy, but it would also bleed into law enforcement policy. So whether he's thinking of himself as like, he's still the crime, you know, the mafia pursuing U.S. attorney, or he's like the wannabe Secretary of State, or he's just a friend of the president, those distinctions maybe don't really matter as much to him as his feeling that he should be accorded the respect of a cabinet official or any of those things, maybe all of them put together.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Tillerson. That was in your book. You referenced the presence of Tillerson there, who very famously apparently said that he didn't think there should be a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And I think a lot of people sort of paused on that because it seemed appalling in the moment. But then watching sort of China expand into some of these countries and what serves as norms in these countries was placing, I think, in a lot of people's minds, sort of us at a competitive disadvantage. But I wonder if Tillerson was reacting to the fact that part of what Giuliani could do is what we typically call, like in sort of the dark and spooky world, you know, back channels, because he's being paid. You know, back channels aren't usually people who are being paid handsomely, but people who understand the region maybe have some history, whether in the CIA or state, and know people and, you know, can make calls.
Yeah. And I think that is sort of the best case argument for this type of like back channel foreign influence that characterizes accurately a lot of the stuff that's going on in the book. Not the best case version of it, but that is the way that these people see themselves. So Paul Manafort is, in many ways, he's like the godfather of this industry, the foreign influence industry. And it is true that during the Reagan and first Bush administrations, Manafort was serving as a sort of like de facto unofficial back channel between the U.S. intelligence community. He had a great relationship, long relationship with William Casey, the CIA director, and others, Jim Baker, and some of these, again, less than savory sort of U.S. client states that the U.S. had this uneasy embrace with, say, Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, because like this is a brutal dictator. He is clearly not aligned with U.S. ideals about democracy and human rights and freedom of expression and the like. Yet he has cast himself, I think, largely with Manafort's assistance, as the bulwark against communism, against the Soviet in the Pacific. Same thing with Jonas Savimbi, the guerrilla leader in Angola, just an absolute brutal thug, like a monster whose civil war against the Angolan government like cost nearly 500,000 lives. Yet he sort of argued, again, with Manafort's assistance, in this case directly, where Manafort brought him to Washington and took him to CPAC and presented him as like, this is your freedom fighter against Cuban and Russian and Chinese influence in Africa. And the foreign policy apparatus in Washington was like, yeah, that sounds right. And they were willing to support his guerrilla war for a number of years, to the point where Bill Bradley, the former U.S. senator from New Jersey, after that, the war eventually ended because Savimbi was killed, I think, 2002. He said, like, this war would have been over years ago were it not for Manafort's extremely effective advocacy in bringing this guy to Washington and selling him as, like, the freedom fighter. And Manafort says that in an interview with me. He basically acknowledges, yeah, that's what I did. And he said, essentially, like, U.S. interests are not always the interest of democracy, you know, that like U.S., it's more complicated, basically espousing a sort of realpolitik that would favor supporting some of these really bloodstained characters because they align with a particular U.S. interest at a particular point in time, even if they were completely anathema to like U.S. ideals about how government and society should work.
I think the other thing that you do a good job of is you don't lay it completely at the door of like this administration or even Trump one. And I think that's smart. I mean, we have done business with absolutely appalling people. I was thinking recently about, you know, Duvaliers in Haiti. Just as an example, it's in our region, just the people that we've been willing to try to deal with. But then there's also sort of another, I guess, positive side of it, which is if you don't try to bring them in and you don't try to get them into a little bit of compliance and in a relationship with a government that's maybe run better, then even worse can occur. But let's talk for a second about Louis Free. I mean, he was sort of America's darling, this cherubic-faced former FBI agent, former federal judge, former AUSA, who was so Catholic that he didn't really want to deal with Bill Clinton, as, you know, so the blue dress and all of that unpleasantry was unfolding. What the heck happened to him? And does it have anything to do with his long-term relationship, inevitably, with Giuliani? Because they worked together and they were both very effective and good at what they did.
Yeah, I mean, and they continued to work together in this foreign influence space. I don't necessarily have like a chicken or egg that like Rudy led Louis Free into it or not, but like you could see why they would both appeal in similar ways to some of these foreign clients. In Louis Free's case, what he was selling was not necessarily like the luster of America's mayor, but rather this idea that he was the FBI director, and like if you wanted to, if you had like a crime problem in your country and you needed someone to consult with prosecutors or law enforcement, he would be a good person to hire. And that was both because maybe he would have actually actionable advice, but also because like you could be able to say to the U.S., like, sure, we got this narcotics problem or this terrorism problem, but look at the guys who we brought in to advise us. And that would go a long way to like assuaging concerns. But what Louis Free did that went a little further than Rudy Giuliani, although they both overlapped together, was he became known for sort of helping to whitewash the track records of people who were actually in the crosshairs of prosecutors, both in the U.S., but more to the point, abroad. So these were like anti-corruption prosecutions around the world that were being supported by the U.S. So the U.S., as you know, would go to its allies and be like, hey, we'd love to continue supporting you, but you got this big corruption problem. You need to take care of it. And so, you know, these prosecutors would go after very high profile people in their own countries for certainly in some cases justifiable like corruption prosecutions. And in several cases, I found Louis Free would go to work for the targets of the prosecutions. In other words, the defendants, they would commission him to write these independent, I'm using the air quotes here, reports about how this corruption prosecution is flawed and the client was not afforded due process and here's why. So, you know, it's independent, I guess, and that maybe he was writing it, but like these people all sort of knew what they were getting, that the report was going to say, actually, this person's not so bad and it's the prosecutors who are really in the wrong here. And so we have examples of him representing a French-Israeli mining magnate facing bribery charges, a Malaysian prime, and these are recent, by the way, these are like in the first Trump administration, a Malaysian prime minister who was implicated in the plundering of billions of dollars in public pension funds, that's Najib Razak, among others. Actually, this is an instance that really ties it all together and shows how this is a bipartisan thing, where Hunter Biden, of course, the son of the former president and former vice president, at the time when Joe Biden was vice president, Hunter Biden was recruited to help a Romanian real estate magnate who was, again, being prosecuted as part of an anti-corruption campaign that was supported by the U.S. and supported, more to the point, by Joe Biden in his role as sort of the international statesman of the Obama administration. So this real estate magnate, he hires Hunter Biden to try to essentially get out from under the Romanian prosecutor's case. And, you know, Hunter Biden works with him for a while, and it's actually interesting what Hunter Biden does. But one of the things that he does is when he wants to get out of the sort of legal representation, I should say Hunter Biden was a real lawyer, so he's hired to help him with this case, but he also was trying to do a business deal with this guy. And so when he wanted to get out of the legal side of it, who does he bring in? Louis Free. Hunter Biden brings in Louis Free. They have a relationship from Delaware. Louis Free is friends with the Bidens. And so he brings him in, and Louis Free starts drafting a report that's going to say this real estate magnate is great and the prosecution is flawed. And then the Biden administration ends. And of course, Donald Trump is president. And so this real estate magnate tells Louis Free, like, man, we the Bidens aren't going to do us much good under Trump. So who does Louis Free bring in to help make the case? Rudy Giuliani. So Rudy Giuliani, Louis Free, and Hunter Biden basically all work for the same corrupt Romanian real estate magnate.
So many jokes come to mind that would not be appropriate for this podcast that I will just pass on them. I mean, some of this stuff was frankly shocking. And if you watch MSNBC or Fox News, you choose, you know, whatever your camp is, I really think that you don't get how incestuous this is, regardless of party, particularly when it comes to the foreign influence. Before I get completely off this topic, though, one of the things that I thought about a lot when I was reading your book was how many of the countries that were spending millions of dollars on these people had received millions, if not billions of dollars from the United States in aid packages. And in many of those countries, I think we know or expect that that money's not going to go where it's intended. It's not going to be purposed toward genuine rule of law efforts. And I sort of feel like, you know, the American taxpayers are pumping this money out, and then it's being swept up by a discrete number of individuals of both parties, sort of both political persuasions. And I just feel like it's a circle. And maybe I'm suggesting your next book. I just feel like the average American taxpayer ought to have something to say about this. It's appalling. One of the other things that crossed my mind is how many these people, they have no foreign policy background. You know, you may be the mayor of New York. You may be the best FBI agent in the world. That doesn't translate to having some sort of PhD in statecraft. But apparently you don't need it, because I thought some of the funnest parts of your book were about this guy Strick. I mean, talk about fake it until you make it. Where in the heck did this guy come from? This is the movie script ready to be written, don't you think?
I have actually talked to a screenwriter about the optioning it and optioning the Strick story in particular. Yes, I mean, he's an extremely colorful character that brings to light sort of several key dynamics of this industry. First of all, on the backstory, you're right. He does come out of nowhere. He had been sort of a lower level lobbyist in the Bush 2 administration.
Well, I mean, was he even that? I mean, wasn't he like a wine guy, and he was in trouble all the time? He wasn't paying his bills. Maybe it's not shady business deals. He bought a store.
Yeah, so he had tried to sort of break into lobbying before the Bush administration. He was from Arizona and he worked for some Arizona Republicans. And during the Bush 2 administration, he came to Washington for the first time and hung out his shingle and represented some small defense contractors seeking contracts, really like low-level lobbying. And then when Obama won in 2008, he suddenly realized like he just had no juice. All his contacts were on the Republican side. And so, yeah, he left Washington. He bounced around the country and bought a winery. At one point, he tried to buy a security guard business. And like all of these ventures failed spectacularly. And he still had the political itch. And like a lot of people, a lot of Republicans who were sort of like in the lower tiers of Republican politics, they saw Trump and Trump's campaign in 2015, 2016 as like their opportunity, because the more established Republican operatives and consultants and lobbyists kept their distance from him because they regarded him as, you know, totally offensive and anathema to like Republican ideals. And there's still some of those who regard him as such, even as he's kind of worn down the Republican establishment and taken it over in many ways. But Strick found an opening, and he was sort of an informal consultant to Corey Lewandowski, who was the campaign manager for Donald Trump's 2016 campaign, and forged relationships with other people on the campaign. And then when Trump shocked everyone and won, it was this dynamic like I was talking about with Rudy Giuliani, where suddenly all the professional gatekeepers and lobbyists and people in the sort of foreign policy apparatus outside of the government who would have been in prime position had Hillary Clinton won, because that's what everyone expected, they had no juice. And people who had nothing except, like, in some cases, the most fleeting connection to Trump's world, and I would put Robert Strick in that category, were in high demand regardless of the subject matter expertise or lack thereof. And Strick, I mean, there's a few funny stories in the book about Strick, like stumbling, you know, realizing this and working quite a hustling way to capitalize on this dynamic, but finding himself in all these scenarios where suddenly he has an audience with, you know, either an elected official or a diplomat from some country. As the people who worked with him said on the record of the book, he couldn't find planet Earth on a globe. Like he didn't know where these countries were, and he would watch a movie. There's a story that I have an anecdote in the book where he goes to Somalia, and to prepare, he watches Black Hawk Down, and it's like that's his soul grounding on Somalia, and he's meeting with the president of Somalia after like watching Black Hawk Down on the flight, and that's his impression of this. So it really disrupted the industry, the foreign influence industry, really the entire influence industry, K Street as a whole, when Trump came in, and it empowered people, some of whom did have some chops in the sort of spaces, that subject area expertise in the spaces that they were seeking to move into, and others who had nothing but claims of Trump connections, which, you know, Strick did have, and he was able, first breakthrough is a totally chance encounter with a New Zealand diplomat at a bar in Georgetown who's complaining about how, you know, it's during the transition period, Trump had just won, and her embassy is unable to even get a congratulatory phone call through from their prime minister to Trump because they don't even know who to call. Trump doesn't have his team around him, and the State Department is sort of siloed away from the Trump transition team. And Strick offers to get the cell phone of Trump for the ambassador, and does. And they call and they get through to Trump, but they're unable to originally pass it through to the prime minister. And eventually they get it done. And it's like, Strick might not know anything about New Zealand, but he had the cell phone number of the president-elect of the United States, and like that was good enough. I thought he was like an interesting character who was emblematic of the disruption of this industry that occurred under Trump.
This is probably one of the more delightful passages in the book. Definitely reads like a movie. Yeah, I bet you do sell this. I bet somebody does option it. Let's circle back to Hunter Biden again for a second. We may have hit on this briefly. There's like this Venn diagram, and it seems like these people overlap. There was a Giuliani-Hunter Biden overlap that you've mentioned. Two things is, how much overlap did he have with sort of other people in the Republican sphere? But then moving away from that, I have to say I was rattled by the parts of your book where it appeared that Biden attended some of these meetings. And you draw a distinction between sort of the moral principles, if you will, of the people who were in the Obama White House as compared to the people in the Biden White House, levels of discomfort. There was a place where they contacted you. They did not want you writing things. And I have to say, the individual who contacted you was on Bill Maher a week ago, yucking it up, you know, having a good night. And I immediately flashed on sort of her visage sitting there cracking it up and that part of the book. And I found that upsetting.
Yeah, I think first I'll backtrack to the good point that you raised on the distinction between the Obama administration and the Biden administration. Obama was sort of an outsider himself. He's a U.S. senator, but he came from like the government reform world. I mean, he was a board member of the Joyce Foundation in Chicago, an organization that has as one of its key missions, like reducing the role of money and lobbying in politics. And he introduced a provision that was enacted into the law in the HLOGA, Honest Leadership in Government Act. This was like the post Jack Abramoff lobbying reform bill. And he introduced a provision that was intended to require lobbyists to report when they were bundling campaign contributions for a given candidate or party committee. And like that was not an act. I mean, I think like a lot of the politicians embrace sort of reform efforts because they think it sounds good. And they talk about like trying to get money out of politics. Like Obama really did want to do that. And one of the first sort of points at which like his desire to do that ran against the cold reality of the way that Washington works was when he picked Joe Biden as his vice presidential running mate. And Joe Biden had this son, Hunter Biden, who at the time was a registered lobbyist. I mean, he didn't represent some of these like unsavory foreign figures that he would come to represent as an unregistered lobbyist later. But he represented a gambling company, or it's like a poker company, represented some universities. And the Obama folks said, like, look, your son's got to deregister. Like, we cannot have the vice presidential nominee have a son who's a lobbyist. And Hunter Biden really bristled at that. If you read his memoir, he was like upset by that. And so Obama tried, I think, he did enact a number of policies during his presidency that were intended to reduce the power of lobbyists. And it was just hard. And particularly when you have people around him who are professional, sort of permanent members of the permanent professional class in Washington, D.C., who cycle through this revolving door between government and the private sector and lobbying firms and consulting firms, which included a lot of the people at the tippy top levels of Biden world, like Steve Ricchetti was a lobbyist. Anita Dunn, these are people who like do this for a living when they're not in government. So like Biden didn't really buy into the, you know, good government operating principles that drove Obama. And so, sure, Hunter Biden deregistered during the Obama administration. But like as it went on, and particularly in the second term, when it was unclear if Joe Biden was going to run for president in 2016, obviously ultimately didn't, deferred to Hillary Clinton. But also same thing with Rudy Giuliani. As Hunter Biden found himself in like financial problems because of his personal problems, in his case, the addiction issues, as well as his brother's illness and eventual death from, you know, terrible form of brain cancer and marital problems that Hunter Biden had leading to a costly divorce. Like he just gradually moved more and more into this foreign influence space following these big paydays. And yes, he knew. I mean, there's no doubt that he knew that the selling point for him was that his father was the sitting vice president. And his father, you know, there's like conflicting accounts about how much he knew and when he knew and whether he was sort of intentionally shielding his eyes from what his son was doing. But I recount a few instances where he actually would come to meetings with a dinner while he was vice president with Hunter Biden's foreign business clients and partners and prospective clients and partners. And there was this expression that he would use, Joe Biden, including while he's vice president. This was recounted by Devin Archer to me. This is a former Hunter Biden business partner who said that Joe Biden would say, "You do something for me, Joe Biden, you're a friend. You do something for my son, Hunter Biden, you're a friend for life." And so there's sort of this tacit signaling is going on that I do think feeds into a perception of this pay-to-play politics that is like so common in so many different parts of the world that we in the US like to think that we're above because we have all these laws and rules that are intended to prevent that type of thing from occurring. And in fact, in the rest of the world, they don't see it that way. They think that we're the same. And it's because we've kind of given them reason to in some of these very high level cases. And I think Hunter Biden and Joe Biden were sort of, whether tacitly or actively, a part of this phenomenon that really makes it hard for us to have the moral high ground when it comes to preaching about clamping down on corruption and having ethics rules and transparency and all the things that we like to think are such key tenets of our government and our sort of regulatory regime.
Very early in your book, there was something that I wasn't expecting. And I say this because at a point in my life, I worked as a book reviewer. And one of the books that I had occasion to review was something called the Venona Papers, which recounted the Venona Papers. And for listeners who don't know what that is, that was a little moment in time after Glasnost, the Soviet Union opened up its KGB archive. And in that archive, a lot of things happened, like, you know, the Rosenbergs' involvement was confirmed. But there were other things. And one of the things that you mentioned in your book blew me away. Talk for a second about Sam Dickstein.
Yeah. So this is a guy who was, in some ways, deserves credit for FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which was passed in 1938 and was then and is still like the key law that we have for, you know, regulating or certainly tracking foreign lobbying. And the impetus for it was Nazi propaganda that was being spread by paid public relations operatives in the United States that was, you know, largely intended to whitewash the horrors of the Third Reich as they were unfolding, with an eye towards keeping the U.S. out of World War II. There was already this like America First movement where there were Americans who were inveighing against the U.S. entering the war and people who were pushing for the U.S. to enter the war. And so, yeah, there was a benefit to the Nazis and to Hitler to pay American public relations firms to sort of present what's going on. And, you know, here's the good things that are happening in Germany. And Congress under Samuel Dickstein, who was chairman of, it was then the House Immigration and Naturalization Committee, caught wind of this. They held some hearings that really did spotlight what was going on in a way that was quite dramatic. I mean, there's one guy who was like hauled before Congress and like admits that one of the people met with Hitler and that they were, you know, essentially doing the bidding of the Third Reich under the guise of working for the German railway, which again sort of echoes some of the foreign influence efforts that we see in the U.S. even now, where there's like a foreign company that's linked to the state that is doing the work, and they can say, the lobbyists or PR people can say, I don't work for that regime, I work for this private company. Dickstein's committee really put the lie to that, and the Foreign Agents Registration Act was signed into law in June of 1938 as a result of their efforts. And then, as you mentioned, this like really sort of shocking and ironic coda, half a century after Dickstein's death, these papers in this dusty Moscow archive revealed that while he was pushing for the Foreign Agents Registration Act, he was secretly accepting thousands of dollars a month from the Soviet spy agency to provide information on Soviet critics and to assist with immigration and citizenship matters. And so when there were efforts to sort of like clamp down on the Russians, the Soviets, he was like in Congress disparaging them and trying to undermine them as, quote, a red baiting excursion while he was being paid by the Russians. And so to me, it's really emblematic of like how difficult it is to really stamp this type of stuff out. I mean, particularly now where you're relying on a law that is, you know, almost 100 years old to capture some of the very sophisticated, you know, social media type of manipulations that we see foreign governments engaging in to try to influence U.S. politics. But even at the time, as this law was being passed, the guy who was behind it was secretly working for one of the foreign interests that had a stake in the outcome. Obviously, the Soviets ended up being averse to the Nazis in World War II, but having an insider in Congress who is like the guy on foreign influence, you could see how that would be quite beneficial to the Russians.
Well, and it might also, you know, there have been a lot of complaints about the FARA statute being particularly anemic. I mean, one of the things that crossed my mind when I read this, and I didn't remember this entry in the Venona Papers, but it did make me wonder if one of the things that he could do in that position was to make the statute really not that great.
That's interesting. I hadn't even thought of that. There was like a push right after Farah was passed where there were some prosecutions, including, by the way, of one of the people who was involved in that German railway thing was one of the first convictions. But then, you know, as you're well aware, and I'm sure your listeners are well aware, there was like a long period where Farah was basically ignored just as a matter of course that like the people who were doing this type of business just simply didn't register under, regarded as optional. And we saw the pendulum swing back during the first Trump administration with the Mueller investigation, where a number of prosecutions were brought, some successfully using Farah as among the statutes. But even there, too, we saw a number of prosecutions that were spawned from the Mueller investigation that resulted in acquittals, or where there were investigations that didn't result in charges being brought at all because there were concerns that, like, that this is probably like, even though this like looks really bad, it looks like intentionally hiding the ball, Farah was just insufficient to be able to really clamp down on this type of activity.
Yeah, and going back for a second, one of the things, you know, we talk about how this thing is metastasized in Washington in terms of the foreign influence. I think six members of Congress went to jail for violating their franking privileges because it wasn't just this Dickstein guy taking money from the Soviets, but people were actually putting Nazi propaganda into the record, standing on the floor of the Senate and in the House and saying these wild things at a time when I guess we didn't understand that the Holocaust was ongoing, but it was. It really is just to show how long this has been going on, how serious it is, and how you can't really expect Congress to police themselves and write the correct law because heretofore they have not. This kind of book, people need to read it. So let's say we're rewriting FARA right now, and what would we think? And I know you're not a lawyer, but your bio says you're married to one. So I'm going to assume that you've absorbed some of it by osmosis. So I think one of the things is it exists as a registration offense. It would certainly have to have more robust penalty provisions. There would have to be some sort of transparency that isn't in the registration that no one sees, but in every single post and every single message. And anything you put on social media or you put in the newspaper, it would have to explicitly state that it was paid for and coming from a foreign government, whether it's a company or not. I think as written, you know, maybe it's not the strongest law we have. Maybe it needs some work.
Yeah, and it's tricky. Like, I recognize, I mean, I agree with you. It would be great if everyone who was like on the payroll of a foreign government would put in their tweets that, like, this is consistent with Justice Department, whatever the regulations are that implement FARA, this is paid communication. There is like a tricky freedom of speech issue here. And that's certainly like, I think the rationale for some of these laws being like quite deferential to like anyone who might cast themselves as media. So, like, you know, Rudy Giuliani does a podcast with Milorad Dodik. And I called Rudy's people and I was like, hey, is he going to register under FARA for this? Well, no, he's acting as a member of the media. And I'm like, you know, I guess like who is the law to say who's a member of the media? And so it's a tricky sort of issue to see like how you could sort of update and enhance FARA to be more equipped to capture some of the influence activities which are happening in this space that are like not always the traditional backroom lobbying, you know, smoky backroom or steakhouse meal lobbying. I would be careful. I would be nervous about an update of FARA that would try to draw a delineation between people who claim that they're media and who should have press protections and those who shouldn't. I think that's you're sort of asking for it there.
I think that's a good point. I mean, I think there are, but I think there must be ways to manage the First Amendment concerns, and there certainly have been in other contexts. I had a great time talking to you tonight and had a great time reading the book. I read it very quickly, and I do recommend it to others. And I look forward to seeing your next. I hope someone in Hollywood picks up the Strick story because, oh my God, let me
Me
just
too.
say that
And I
again.
enjoyed the chat too.
All right, we'll hyperlink to vendors where you can get Devil's Advocate. It's good reading, something you need to know, as I've mentioned, as a national security lawyer. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to subscribe to NSLT on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon. You can like and share this episode with a friend. I ask you to do these things, not because I'm a wild about social media, because I recognize these trigger the algorithm and they amplify our content. We try to have thoughtful content here and have a good discussion on NSLT. And we try to avoid, you know, partisan politics. It's not our thing. Remember, unity is a key feature of our national security. Even when we can't agree, we can agree to listen to each other. We remain fortunate to live in a country with greater diversity of thought than any other, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing that writers like Kenneth Vogel can publish books like this here in the United States and promote them. The writer, producer, and host of NSLT is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is Holly McMahon, who has literally worked for 22 hours for the past, 10, 15 days, and she's still awake. And we're forever grateful to the brilliant minds of the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security who pursue the good without regard for politics or party. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.